It's 10:06. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen will be back on Monday. We probably take for granted the idea that someone is working to preserve culture so that future generations will know what we wore, what we watched, what we listened to, what we read, what we were singing to ourselves while we waited for traffic lights to change. But do you ever stop to think about who it is who has made it possible for us to know about our own past cultural landmarks, where we came from, the things that have been handed down from generation to generation? Somebody had to go around and talk to people, find out about their history, their folklore, their music. If not, well, we would have been denied the opportunity to sample the rich and diverse cultural heritage of our own past. Well, one such person was Alan Lomax. A new biography titled Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World, is now available, and we have the author of this work with us this morning. Joining me by telephone is John Swed, author of this biography. He's an anthropologist, jazz scholar, and acting director of the Center for Jazz Studies in the Department of Music at Columbia University. Good morning, Professor Swed, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really appreciate getting a chance to talk to you because I must confess that I was woefully ignorant about the work of Alan Lomax until I got a copy of your book and started to look into it. And unfortunately, we only have an hour because I don't even know if I have a good idea of where to start this interview, and that's an embarrassing thing for a talk show host to say, but there's just so much here. Alan Lomax, when you said the man who recorded the world, that's not hyperbole. He went everywhere, and he recorded all kinds of things.
Well, he tried to record the world, and it seems like a crazy idea, but it was done in anger. He had tried to sell academics on the idea that somebody should be putting all these things together since the long-playing record came in, and I think he figured out that the timing of a long-playing record, which is, I don't know, 40 minutes, 40-some minutes, if you stretch it, was about the amount of material you could get in a small book that would cover the same thing, and he thought that was a very up-to-date thing to do. But the academics thought it was, I don't know exactly what they were objecting to. They seemed to think it was impossible, and they couldn't get agreement on it. And he got angry and decided to do it himself, and it was... That's only the beginning of it. He didn't have any money. He left the country with $3,000. This is back in 1950-51, and $3,000 wouldn't have carried him 1 year. It was actually he thought he could do this in a year. I know it sounds crazy, but if you were ever around this guy, you would understand that he was never there. There are a few people who aren't stopped by either space or time. You tell them they don't have the time, they'll do it. If you don't have the space, they'll just burst through it. And that's what he was like.
He would admit no impediment. Let's start with how you first became acquainted with Alan Lomax's work.
Oh, I'm just see you're thinking of dates. I think, well, the name had flickered in the back of my mind because his father had preceded him and had put the word folk song on the map. There was really folk song is a very late word, actually. It doesn't come into English, in America at least, till fairly late. And he'd been a collector of cowboy songs, that is his father, John. And cowboy songs were, let's see, thinking back now to the 20s, were cowboys, the country was in love with cowboys, especially when they were starting to disappear, and cowboy movies were beginning to appear and the rest of it. And he was Texan with self-made, self-educated largely. He hadn't gone back to school till he was in his 30s and so forth. He was starting late in life. And he got the backing of Teddy Roosevelt, not financial backing, but Teddy Roosevelt wrote an introduction for him. At any rate, so I knew about the Lomax family faintly through that kind of thing, that there was this history of someone who went out to look for cowboys and hobos and other people later. But I think it was in 1959 when the first stereo recordings came out of the southern trip that Alan Lomax had taken in 59. It took 6 months, and he recorded, well, I was going to say six separate LPs, but he actually brought out a bunch of others after. It was probably at 20-some by the time he was done. And although I was born in the South, and actually in the really deep South, and Utah, Alabama, spelled with an E for the Indians rather than the state. I had no idea that the South had this range of music, and I was stunned by it. It was not just the range. It was, some of it was shocking, I think. A certain preaching style, hellfire and damnation, which, you know, was a cliche, but preachers who were scary, let's put it that way, or groups like some of the really old singers who sang songs that were so slow that you wonder how they had the breath to hold the phrases and how they could keep even a feeling of the meter. Plus, I'd never heard Cajun music and music from Louisiana, and I wasn't alone in that. This is the country didn't know anything about French music until really after 59. I'd never heard bluegrass before. It was just surfacing at that point. So I think that whole 1959 era was a shock to me in a way, and it was to other people. Over the years, I found people sort of came alert to a range of possibilities. And I was trying to become an anthropologist at the time, and I wondered where you would study this sort of thing. And I sort of started hanging around with people, and I encountered him at a meeting of the Society for Ethnomusicology. He was not an ethnomusicologist, but he turned up at these sort of things, and he was sort of overwhelming because he was hanging out with people that I at the time didn't know were, I didn't know who they were, but I didn't know that they were anthropologists, such as Colin Turnbull. Colin Turnbull was an Oxford graduate who was a cross-country running champion and had been the only person alive who had ever been able to stay with the pygmies in the Ituri forest in the Congo because they run all day. These tiny people cover great amounts of territory, and Turnbull had been accepted by them because he could run. In fact, he had markings on his cheeks, the tribal markings of being accepted into the group. And Turnbull wrote very romantic accounts of pygmies, and there was Lomax talking to this guy, and he's talking to another one who specialized in sensory issues, smell and taste and what have you. And these are, as they say nowadays, not your father's anthropologists. They're still pretty far out. So I was fascinated by this meeting of these strange people with strange ideas. That was my first encounter with him.
And well, let's Alan Lomax. You mentioned John Lomax, Alan Lomax's father. Alan Lomax had a really interesting upbringing. He had some health issues as a child, but his parents were both teachers. They were both academics, and they really believed in learning and in education. And they were talk about his upbringing, and then later he actually worked with his father collecting folk music and things during the Depression. Did he not?
Mm-hmm. I think the surprise for me in this, an awful lot of people were self-educated earlier in the century. College graduates were few and far between, and we tend to think that it's sort of an accepted thing that people were going to college. But it really was something for the, if not for the elite, at least for those who put in superhuman efforts to be able to pay their way through college at that time, particularly the Depression coming on and things like that. So John Lomax had cobbled together a career. He'd basically gotten educated as an adult, which I suppose is more common than I thought. But what really surprised me was that it was learning about families at the turn of the century going into, let's say, the 1930s that took a lot of pride in reading things and memorizing them, because they still do that in school to a degree, but apparently it was something that people wanted to do on their own. They would memorize things and be able to quote from them or make jokes about things using these references. Or as kids, they were put on display at home when their parents would have them sing or read something, recite something. And in the process of learning about this, I found that a lot of people in that time didn't make a distinction between written things and non-written things. So it was possible for a child who was asked to perform for his parents' friends might recite from Shakespeare or sing the national anthem or something, but also sing a folk song. So it was kind of a respect, I think, for the unwritten material that we don't make anymore. We don't adhere to. That was sort of a surprise to me. And John Lomax had, he was an academic, but he was barely hanging on. He did teach English at Texas A&M, but he at the University of Texas at Austin, he was head of alumni affairs and more an officer of the university. In fact, that's how he came to be fired when one of the governors of Texas decided didn't like the way the university was going, and he shut the whole university down. Sounds like today. And then finally picked out some scapegoats and fired them, and as the head of the Alumni Association, Alan's father, John, got fired, and that was the end of his academic career, basically. But what he did when he went, when this happened and the Depression hit and then his wife died all at once, John Lomax got deeply depressed, went to bed, and stayed in bed for weeks, barely surviving. And his sons heard about it. He had two sons and a daughter, two daughters at that point. And they tried to get a plan to get him out of his depression. And since, as head of the Alumni Association, he had done a lot of speech making and actually singing some cowboy songs to Texas alumni, they got the idea if he were to go on the road and give lectures, he could make a living doing something he knew, and maybe they'd get him out of his depression. But then they also the idea came up, why not continue putting together these songs and doing something with them like he had done with the cowboy songs? And young Alan was in school at the time, and he was set to go to Harvard on full scholarship, and he dropped out of school to help his father start collecting. This is about 1934. I get shaky at my date. 32. I get shaky at my dates here. 32. And with the help of backing from the Carnegie Foundation, who gave him enough money to travel for a year, but not to live on, just to travel and have a car to use, Alan, young Alan, who was then, I believe, 16, 17, and his father went out for a year throughout the South, going to prisons and work farms and so forth, collecting songs.
How did they collect those songs?
Well, up to this point, almost without exception, I'd say any collections that occurred were done by pencil and paper. And if you can imagine this, when you have to make an accurate record of what someone's saying, you have to keep stopping them and asking them to repeat or to go back. There are other ways to do this, but basically one is to sing along, but that's kind of a crazy one to do. But that's a very slow process and often required a second person to write it down, but that's the way things like this were done in those days. Recordings had appeared, and there were commercial recordings spreading across the country, of course, really quite early in the teens, but especially in the late 20s, they were very big, but they were enormously expensive to produce, and the idea of carrying recording equipment outside of a studio was forbidding. So John Lomax borrowed one of the first recording machines made from Thomas Edison's White Widow, and he took it with him. It was basically a kind of office, something like, what were they called? This little
almost like a dictaphone.
Dictaphone, yeah. Very crude, meant for short messages. Much like, you know, recording with your cell phone or something, but that's digital at least. So, but it was very limited range and very short use. You could never get more than a minute and 17 seconds or so on a recording, and it's very thin and it was perishable. But that's the way they started. But while they were out there, the so-called portable disc player came out. It weighed 350 pounds, not counting the batteries you had to use with it, the crude mixing material, the disc, which were either, they were in the beginning, glass or aluminum, and very heavy. Before that, there'd been wax, but wax melts in the South, and it's always a problem. You have to pack ice in it. This is kind of nightmarish to go out with this stuff, much less going up a creek bed or a back road and climbing up a hill, something his aging father couldn't do, and Alan was, of course, recruited into doing. And this is how the recordings were. And so the very early ones, very few of them survived in listable condition. The Library of Congress has put some of it up, but what Alan seemed to have gotten out of this was that folk songs should be recorded in the finest quality media that could be found at any given time, and he was obsessed with this idea, and no one outdid him on it. He did the first recording with tape in the field. He did the first stereo recording in the field. When the really fine tape recorders started to appear that were minuscule, like the Nakamichi, which were enormously expensive, you know, smaller than a MacBook, for example, he had those. When the first high definition cameras appeared, he had those. Even he had the first one in the country, actually, and no one knew how to use it. It was kind of nightmarish to be going around with this kind of thing. But that was his theory. And the other thought was that they should be recorded in the best quality, but also that the singers and performers should hear themselves in the same quality as radio and television produce things, because otherwise they sounded like archaic and backwoods, and he wanted those people to believe that they were up there, and he wanted them to be able to compete in the marketplace. That was, he was quite successful in that. These things, you know, every recording before these high quality things came in sounded just like what they were, archaic, and as if they were from another age. Suddenly he was pushing this stuff into the modern age, and when he moved to film and video recording, he carried that idea out even further.
We need to take a break, and I also want to give the phone number so that listeners can have a chance. We've already got some emails in, and I know there's at least one caller who wants to join our discussion. Plenty of room for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the book, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. The author of that biography, John Sweat, is with me on the telephone this morning. And we do have some of the recordings that Alan Lomax made. And, in fact, I'm going to play one here as we go into the break. This from somewhere in the 40s. It is a recording of what was titled on the track, Negro Prison and Blues Songs, from the Alan Lomax collection. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
She to me, she to me.
It's 10:25. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back on Monday. The topic this hour is the new biography of Alan Lomax, titled Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World, written by John Sweat. John Sweat is with me by phone, and let's go to the phones because Connie in Madison is with us. And Connie, go ahead.
Good morning. A short question. What is the connection between Alan Lomax and the Smithsonian Folkways recordings? The reason that I ask is that I was completely blown away by a collection of shape note singing that was collected sometime in the 50s, I think. And actually, I've gone on to do just a little bit and dabble in shape note singing. It's an astonishing tradition, religious tradition, a cappella harmony with no instrumental accompaniment. And it's an amazing music. So I'll hang up and just take my comments off the air. I honestly wish I knew the connection.
As the title says, Smithsonian Folkways is a merger of a number of things. The Library of Congress's recordings that was done with Lomax's father and with mostly by Alan in the 40s, and the recordings issued by Mo Ash's Folkways Recordings, a commercial company. But the ones you're talking about, the shape note singers, were done by Alan, who I think is the first person to record that music. It's a music of enormous power and very difficult to record until modern times when the stereo machines came in, because the sheer volume and the complexity of the singing. The groups originally sat in church facing each other and exchanging back and forth. This is music is hard to explain, but it's a different kind of notation than normal music. It was designed, it has a kind of archaic quality of that, too, as if it's pre-writing in some way, but it's also used in ways that we don't normally use music of that sort. The singers switch parts so that people would sing high, would sing low, and so forth, and move them around, partly for interest and partly for the sonic quality of it. But it really is amazing music. In fact, it's interesting that you call, because I just got word yesterday that the American Registry of Recorded Music, which runs out of the Library of Congress, had just added those recordings to their list of the most prized recordings in American history. I'm not sure that most people have ever heard this. I'm trying to think if O Brother, Where Art Thou had some in it. There may have been, but I can't recall. This is one of those, music is hard to talk about, but this is especially hard to talk about. And if you haven't heard this, it's worth trying to find. It's something he found in Alabama and Georgia, where it was more widely spread than that. In fact, the songbooks are still around, and it does give you a sense of enormous history that you don't get from other kinds of recordings in music.
Thank you. Thank you for that call, Connie. We had an email from Dean in New London who says, good to hear of a book on Alan Lomax. I belong to the Green Apple Folk Music Society. Many of our members perform music that Mr. Lomax recorded from the hills of Appalachia. We really appreciate what he did and relish the idea of the general public becoming more familiar with him. He's a folk icon who nobody knows. Thank you for the book. I'll be buying it, and we'll keep on playing it. So you have a fan there in New London.
It's worth mentioning here, I think, that the least known, I think almost the least known of Lomax's work was the work he did up in your area, which right up to the Canadian border. And he would have been, let me think fast for dates, 15, 30, he'd been about 31, is that right? 15, yeah. 30 or 31, he set out to do a four- or five-state project in one and a half months, or maybe even less. Another crazy idea, but he got close to it. And then even got waylaid in Detroit on the way where his car was stolen, but he managed to still do some recording before he left there. And the idea was to record in every state in the Union, which they never quite pulled off when the war came along and things like that. But he was going to try to do, I'm trying to think of the five states, was it five, six? It was outrageous. And at least he was doing it in the summer, because they wanted to do it in the winter, and that would have been ridiculous, the way he was traveling on back roads and so forth. But in the process, he found out that the music of the Great Lakes region and wider and deeper down was much more complex than anyone had known. People had been there before. A woman on the West Coast had done some work there, but most of it was not recorded. So they had some idea of what they were in for. And they had a sense that, particularly as they got near the Canadian border, that communities would be more separate. There would be, you know, French-speaking, Irish, whatever, Polish, and they did find that, or he did find that, but he found out that in these communities, people were crossing the lines into other music. So you'd find some people who didn't speak French who could sing a French song, or people who were Polish who could nonetheless do Irish songs, et cetera, et cetera. And it was intense work in that process. He piled up a lot of recordings that haven't been reissued, but are in the Library of Congress for anyone to use, or possibly even get offline, where they're increasingly put these things up. But it's one of the richer collections and a more complex picture of American music than anyone had at that point. For example, in some of the communities with the most archaic and most ethnic songs, in places like northern Michigan, he found people who were up to date on pop songs and jazz and so forth, and also performed those. And at the same gig, people would be dancing to this whole range of music, sometimes doing it English, sometimes doing it other. Anyway, I just bring this up because it's still not properly known by people that music was documented by 1938. At the same time as he was recording Jelly Roll Morton, his great month-and-a-half-long autobiography of the great New Orleans jazz composer.
Well, it's interesting you bring up northern Michigan, because my mother grew up during the Depression in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and she always has said you had, in order to just be able to play in her neighborhood, you needed to be able to speak three languages, or at least know what all the swear words were. You mentioned Jelly Roll Morton. We've got a caller, I think, who wants to talk about that. Let's go to Aaron in Madison. Aaron, good morning.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was Jelly Roll Morton or Lead Belly, but you introduced in your introduction a relationship between Mr. Lomax and Leadbelly, in which he had helped bail him out of jail. Now I had become interested in Leadbelly's music, surprisingly enough to myself, how interested I was in it, in college. And through word of mouth, I understood the story as Leadbelly going to jail for having gotten in a bar fight and accidentally killing somebody. And while in jail, he was pardoned because I had heard that the warden had enjoyed his music so much that he had given him a pardon and gotten him out of jail for that reason. But I was curious on the relationship between Mr. Lomax and Leadbelly, if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. It's a complex story, but made more complex by people misreporting it over the years. One thing you learn about writing biographies, which is something I never thought I would do, but I seem to end up doing it, is that you, frankly, you find how bad people's memories are, including your own. So I've come to distrust almost anything anybody says to me, and I pursue it. You know, even if it's a casual friend that I've known for years, I say, are you sure? Were you there? And so forth, because a narrative forms that is smooth. It cuts out the edges and the contradictions. In the case of Leadbelly, for example, he was actually in jail three times for attempted murder. The third one is virtually unknown because it somehow fell off the chart as time went by. But the first one was in his own area of the South, where he came up in Louisiana for stabbing. We can't take time to go into the details, but he did, in fact, get out of jail by singing. He'd become a trustee and had certain privileges, but he also performed for garden parties for the governor at the time, and the governor of Louisiana, and that he got the idea that if he worked up a song that would really make a pitch for his pardon, he would get out. But he was already favored by the governor, and the governor did release him. He put in some years at that point. This just reminds me of the sort of the thousand and one nights kind of thing, where as long as you keep singing, you stay alive, or as long as you keep telling stories, they don't kill you, that sort of thing. But he was back in jail for stabbing a white person. These are complex stories in which he said he was being attacked and what have you. And there must have been some merit in it because he didn't get that harsh of sentence on each of these. This is the point where the second stabbing is where the Lomaxes came into the picture and found him in a Texas prison. And they did try to, he asked them, would they record him? And then could the record be given to the governor to make the same magical escape work for him? And they did do this and thought that he got out of prison because of it. But it turned out when they checked years later that the head of the Texas state prison system said he'd been released for good time, not because of the recording, which may or may not have been heard by the governor. However, the story was such a good one that the Lomaxes and Leadbelly altogether kept telling the story of him getting out again. And it started out with him just saying he once got out that way, then it became both times and so forth. Then while Allen was working for the Library of Congress in 1939 and was enrolled as a graduate student, he was on leave, I suppose, at that point, at Columbia University. Leadbelly was there in New York. Leadbelly stabbed a burglar 22 times but didn't kill him, and was thrown into Rikers Island jail. Allen dropped out of graduate school to get money to get a lawyer and try to get him out. And while he was out on parole, Leadbelly stopped a robbery, an armed robbery in a jewelry store up in the Upper West Side of New York, and held the robber till the cops came. So when he came up for sentencing, all this got considered, and he got off, I believe, with 19 months for that. So there's a lot more to the story, but that's already too complex.
Well, let's talk about Jelly Roll Morton, because Alan Lomax did have a relationship with Jelly Roll Morton. And in fact, reading the account of what was a marathon recording session, I was just it was amazing what he was able to get there. And but what led up to that, the dispute between Jelly Roll Morton and Mr. Handy, and let's go to that story next.
No, the thing with Jelly Roll Morton was he had a business card which said that he was the inventor of jazz, and that's, you know, obviously a big statement. And so, and by the time these things took place, these recordings, 1938, the swing era was entering. So the kind of music that Morton had played, a kind of masterful, he was a great pianist, but he was a great writer of material and a arranger of it, and his orchestrations of jazz are unparalleled in the 20s. But, you know, a whole music can wipe out a career very quickly, and that's what was underway. And he was struggling for two things, Morton was. One, to get his place in history recognized, and also to get his music copyrighted, because several of his 1920s things had been turned into 1930s pop hits. King Porter's Stomp was played by all the big bands. It was a great dance number, to name one. And they weren't under his copyright, and he was getting nothing for it, and he was down and out and what have you. And he showed up in Washington at the Library of Congress. Someone had urged him to go and talk to him, and he came in the door and said, when he met young Alan, I invented jazz, and people are stealing my stuff, and I want to tell my story. It's clear now, in retrospect, that though he was exaggerating, he was talking about piano jazz, and he was one of the first people to get recorded on the piano, and he did write and managed to copyright later the first jazz piece for piano, which gives him some kind of edge towards saying that. And I remember reading when I was young someone saying, what do you do when you discover that a guy who makes outrageous claims and appears to be lying and boasts about everything he does, and you consider either a fool or an outright liar, turns out to be three-quarters correct? How do you, and something of a genius at what he does, how do you treat such a person? Well, he's not been treated well in history, and he's often shoved aside. But he once said to Alan something which still registers as right with me. The public relations industry was just starting to get into gear in the 1930s. And Morton, who boasted like crazy about all of his achievements, and he had considerable achievements outside of music, by the way. He was involved with Jack Johnson in putting on an all-black Indianapolis race, for example, which is a strange conjunction. He told Alan that if you hire someone to say that you're the greatest, people will admire you. If you say you're the greatest, they think you're a fool. Well, he got the point of that fast, I think, and but he never could afford a publicist, and continued to handle his own business, and it's a very Southern way of doing things. And my favorite was when he went around to thrift shops and so on and bought not pianos, but he would pay for the ivories off the keys, then sign the keys and use them as business cards. Actually, that's absolutely brilliant. The problem is that the surface didn't hold the ink, so you'd find a couple of days later they were blank. But it was a great idea.
Oh, boy. Well, I want to give the phone number again because I'm sure there are people who would like to ask questions. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The address, talk@WPR.org, if you want to send an email. And you can find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. You can leave a comment there. 800-486-8655. We're talking about Alan Lomax. There's a biography out of this man titled Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World, written by John Swed and published by Viking. We have John Swed with us on the phone, and you can be too at 800-486-8655. As we take a pause here, to collect a few phone calls and reorganize ourselves, I want to play another piece that Alan Lomax recorded. This is David Honeyboy Edwards and a piece of a song called The Army Blues. And this was originally issued on the 1978 album Songs of War and History, published by the Library of Congress.
When I first started at the bombing, Lord, I bombed from town to town. When I first started out the bombing, baby, Lord, I bombed from town to town. gonna leave now, now. Lord, them jobs are turning around.
It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the biography, Alan Lomax, the man who recorded the world, and I have with me on the phone John Zwed, who is the person who wrote it. He's an anthropologist, jazz scholar, acting director of the Center for Jazz Studies of the Department of Music at Columbia University. 800-486-8655. I want to read a quotation you have from Alan Lomax, and I'd like to give some context for this, but he was talking about the New Deal and the things that were happening in the 30s in America, and he said this: "The New Deal was the time for the American Revolution. Was the time the American Revolution began again. It wasn't just dealing with the Depression; it was dealing with all the problems we had accumulated in the 100 years between the time of the American Revolution and then, through selfishness and greed and exploitation. We knew what the problems were. We had been to school, and this was our training. There were tens of thousands of us in that city, all related to the problem and given a go-ahead signal, do something. It was made possible by the New Deal. We had the ear of the common man. All intellectuals were involved. Everybody was in it. The Roosevelts were marvelous orchestrators. We unionized America. We set the base for integration. We set it free from European snobbery. It was a time of exhilaration, a dizzy feeling. By God, we Americans were pretty marvelous." He said that, and the context for this, as I understand it, I mean, there was a feeling among many that the kind of art that John Lomax and Alan Lomax had collected wasn't really art, because it wasn't old, it wasn't European, it didn't have that patina, it wasn't Shakespeare, it wasn't Chaucer. But it seems to me that he was saying, hey, what we discovered was that, yeah, this stuff is art, and it needs to be preserved, and people need to pay attention to it.
It's funny you should use that passage. I don't do much reading. I don't like to read when I do appearances of some sort. But I was at the Jalopy, I think it's technically called the Fabulous Jalopy Theater in Red Hook, New York, across in Brooklyn, recently, where it's kind of a hardcore country old-time music crowd hangs out, and I read that passage, and they all applauded. That was remarkable. Something Alan said to his sister about the Depression still rings true, which was the country was in such bad shape at that point, it was flailing about for some way out so badly that Alan said, if you didn't have an opinion and a solution, you were boring. And he particularly didn't want to be boring, but he... I think that was true. And the people had a wide range of possibilities in the solution, which ranged from everything from revolution to going way back in time and turning the country around to where it was in the 19th century and so forth. And that's part of that. And he also speaking about a generation of people who were sweating blood for the country in some way or another. These were another great generation that's often ignored. The people who, on one hand, were dirt poor, but had nonetheless put in a lot of effort. Now, the question of folk song is complex, because in good times, folk song gets to be an antique, something you bring out, you put on the roadshow for PBS or something or other, and bring it out. And people say, yeah, my grandmother used to do that, and so forth. Then it turns around, the country is not so good, and these songs turn out to be threatening. And what was happening in the Depression was they were moving quickly from being the folksy, down-home, you know, distressed kind of music to turning into subversive. So when they began to make up lists of people to be blacklisted, folk singers and people who collected folk song were prominently on the list. And when I examined the FBI file of Alan Lomax, which was substantial, I believe it was about 8 inches thick, 9 inches thick, that they had virtually nothing on him, although they followed him for 30 years. And every year, somebody in charge of these investigations would say, there's nothing here, let's drop this. and they would drop it, and then somebody would start it again with the same kind of material. But it was nothing but one person's remark, unnamed, et cetera, saying that they heard he said he was a communist. Well, it turns out that in the end they finally said, in fact, he wasn't a communist. No, that was true. But every one of the reports done over these years enlisting why he was suspicious was that he liked folk songs, that he hung out with folk singers and Negroes, as they would say, and they would refer to Leadbelly usually with his name spelled wrong, and that he was concerned with the downtrodden. Now, what's weird is that the whole country was concerned with the downtrodden at that point because so many people were out of work. I forget, what was it, 40% of the country was out of work?
Yeah, it was a pretty big number. Yeah.
So it's odd to bring that up as something subversive because that 40% was concerned for sure, and an awful lot of the efforts in the country were geared to them. But one had the sense that the FBI was out of phase with the country at that point, and maybe I'll be a little kinder about it. They were as threatened as everybody else by the way it was going, and so they grabbed at straws. And when you look at the list that Allen ended up on in 1949-50, he was in with Orson Welles and I'm trying to think of some of the movie stars, people that you would never dream that would be accused of being subversive, but somehow or other, because of their taste or their interest, they wound up in that situation. So when Allen is talking about those people in Washington, he meant those people who were very young. He was very close to filmmakers at that point. Nicholas Ray, who made Rebel Without a Cause, and Joris Evens, a great European filmmaker, then living in a documentary maker in New York, and also people not as well known perhaps today. Well, Ilya Kazan for sure is known. You know,
and he was also
Desire and so on.
He was also pretty close to Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger,
Burl Ives,
yeah.
And lots of people long since not so popular, but still great people, like the Golden Gate Quartet, who at that time Hollywood stars as well as folk singers.
Well, the phones are full, and I don't know that we'll get to all of them before 11 o'clock, but we'll sure try. Let's start with Dan in Ironwood.
Yeah, hi. I was on my cell phone. I was driving across US 2 in Wisconsin in the UP. And heard your comments about his recordings up here. And I had the pleasure to work with Dr. Jim Leary at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is in the process of compiling all those recordings from the Library of Congress in the hope of releasing them sometime soon. And just wanted you to comment on that. And also, I think he might be a great guest for your show sometime in the future. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dan.
That's a great idea. I know Leary's work and keep track of it. And he's tireless, and he's done a little book, and he's given lectures. I think you can even get a recording of one of his lectures on this. He's very good about it. And I'd say this, that 10 minutes of sampling those recordings would change everyone's view of that region. It certainly did me, and I think it did Allen as well. You suddenly see a kind of unity and diversity, if you know what I mean. Diversality, or whatever it would be. It's a region held together in its complexity by something or other.
Well, I've lived up in northern Wisconsin for pretty much, just about my entire life, not the whole of it. And, yes, I would have to agree with you completely on that.
And I don't think the rest of the country has a clue, by the way.
Well, we've always thought this. We've always thought the rest of the country didn't have a clue.
It's always the safe thing to say in any part of the country.
Yes, that's right. You know, it's we feel perfectly fine about the fact that New York and Los Angeles believe there's a void in the map that with Chicago as an island. Let's go next to Tony in Shorewood. Hi, Tony.
Hello. How you doing? I wondered if the author had encountered another chronicler of folk music and folk performers. By the name of Chris Strachwitz, who comes from the San Francisco Bay Area and went around the country, very similar to Allen, with a portable recorder and recorded a lot of these same, I think, types of folk music and put them out on his own record label called Arhuli Records. And do you know of Chris Strachwitz and his efforts, and how do they fit in with Allen's work?
I do know him, and in fact, he and Lomax knew each other well. I'm staring right now at, it's not exactly a box set, as you would say. It's sort of a book called Hear Me Howlin', Blues, Ballads, and Beyond, is recorded by the San Francisco, is recorded by the San Francisco Bay by Chris Strachwitz in the 1960s. It's a very nice book, but it also contains several, four CDs? Yeah, four CDs of much material, which is much of which is not issued. And it really shows you just how much music and how wide a range of music you could hear in the San Francisco Bay before he traveled outside. This is kind of astonishing. I had no idea that, even though I knew him and his work, I had no idea that such music was traveling so well. Yeah, I was always a fan of his, and I think he was born in Europe, wasn't he?
I don't think Tony's still with us. Let's thanks, Tony, for that call. Let's go to AJ in Oshkosh next.
Hello.
Hi, AJ. Good morning. Go ahead.
Start with a comment, a quick quote, and then a question. The comment is going back to your the author's statement about if you didn't have an opinion, you were boring. Speaks loads of Will Rogers and his popularity. But I think the quote is that Daniel Borstein, the eminent historian, once said, history is a matter of what has survived. And I would suppose with Alan Lomax and his dad, had they not collected and had not others collected, we would not have a history that we have. My question is that at some point, Alan Lomax apparently becomes the head of the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress. And in 1940, here in Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Folk Music Project for the Library of Congress. I'm guessing at some point, and this is my question, that Mr. Lomax must have understood, I can't do all this. My dad and I can't collect all of this. What was his role in promoting the releasing of federal funds to do these types of things around the country?
Good question. And I keep saying these are complex, but they are. There's things that took me forever to unravel, and they're very hard to remember. He was never head of that archive. They never had a head, which is even weirder. His title was assistant in charge of, and it properly reflected what he was paid. His starting pay was about $1,600 a year in 1937-38, and that's about a day laborer's yearly income. If you were working at that time, and he did get raised slightly upward, but never to what you would call a real, you know, if he was a bureaucrat, he was poorly paid as such. He would have liked to have recorded everything and sure made an effort. He went down to Kentucky and Ohio and Tennessee and tried to cover that whole region, and he would get frustrated because the travel was so hard and there was such diversity, and that's what happened also when he got he kept calling the Great Lakes region, but it was really further than that. He thought he could do it till he got there. Then he became overwhelmed, and he got exhausted. He got sick. And, he didn't have the money to cover things. People expected sometimes to be paid, and he didn't have the money to pay because the Library of Congress didn't pay anyone for that kind of thing. So he started, as you surmised, he started to find people who could do this elsewhere, and he always credited those people who he hoped would do these things in Kentucky and in your region. Both he found professors and fans and musicians who had the will to do it. And that's how many of these recordings reached the Library of Congress and is still there waiting for somebody to deal with. By the way, you should know that these are all in public domain, these recordings, and anyone could produce a recording based on them.
You know, we're almost out of time. I knew this would happen. We didn't even get to all the work that Lomax did in Europe for the BBC and the adventures that he had there. But it's all in the book. I guess as a closing question, one of the things that made me think of this as I was reading, you know, he found all this stuff. This is one man, but I wonder sometimes what we missed, you know, because he couldn't find everything. I wonder what was out there that we will never know about because we only had one person going out and doing this work. Do you think about that at all?
Yeah, I think it's still true. I mean, it's generally assumed there's nothing much new to find, but with the collapse of the recording industry, we don't have the kind of scouts that used to go out and do this sort of thing. That kind of thing was collapsing anyway before this. Yeah, I hesitate to say that we know really what we have around us. And he came in later years to see this as a kind of a parallel to the biodiversity issue, that you worry about the loss of species of anything because, in a sense, they're a solution or an answer to a problem that we may not even know is a problem, if you can follow
and,
that.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
John Sweat, anthropologist, jazz scholar, acting director of the Center for Jazz Studies at the Department of Music at Columbia University, and author of Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and for Chrissy Pease for on-air production. We're going out with Vera Hall. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Have a great day.
Ooh, Lord, trouble so high when in the